Welcome, everybody. It's me, your host, Kara, and we have our super fantastic returning co-host, Helen Green, with us this evening. So welcome, everybody. We're glad to be here. And don't worry, Eric is not gone for good. We're just filling in this time for him, so he will be back. We did not kidnap him and put him in a trunk or anything like that. You'll see him again. And let me introduce our guest, who I am super excited about. This evening we have Tora Bondrager. Again, she's back with us for, I believe it's the third time. And a little bit about Tora, she escaped in the middle of the night at age 15 so she could go to high school. She's the author of Amish Girl in Manhattan, and to her knowledge is the first female Amish escapee to graduate from the Ivy League. Her story's been featured on MTV and Forbes, among others, and today she advocates for the right of Amish children to go to school beyond the eighth grade. Tora founded the Amish Heritage Foundation, which focuses on making education a federal right and overturning the Supreme Court case Wisconsin v. Yoder, which she talked about a little bit last time. And without further ado, let's go ahead and bring Tora on.
Hi, thank you so much, Kara, for having me back. It's one of my things that I look forward to is the recovering from religion episodes. They're just amazing. And it's an honor to be back and be able to share these different topics and issues that we're all interested in.
Yes, so glad to have you again.
Yeah, welcome back, Tora.
I never expected to be invited back, much less three times. So a huge honor. Thank you. So I was wondering if should I go ahead and click share screen and see if my slide shows. So I'll start off that way. And let me just know if that appears the way it should on your end.
We are seeing it now. Yep, there it is. Presentation is up.
Awesome. All right. So tonight, as the title that we had discussed, it's the supremacy of religious rights in the shadow of a pandemic. And we are going to talk about specifically that Columbia Law School report that Kara mentioned. And in brief, in the United States, laws have been created and upheld that favor religious freedoms over the health and well-being of US citizens. Tonight, we'll discuss the supremacy of religious rights over other basic human rights, including education. And that's also a theme of the Amish Heritage Foundation's work and the topic of our upcoming conference.
Fantastic.
So this report, oh, go ahead, Kara.
Oh, no, I was saying this is super interesting to me. I am so excited to hear your rundown on this report because I have not fully read it yet. So please tell us, what is this?
Well, it's something I really went down a rabbit hole with it, and I'm hoping I can get it condensed enough tonight that it, it keeps you interested and doesn't bore you. So that's my only worry.
Oh, you are never boring. Don't worry about that.
I always learn something cool when you're here. So
nice.
I'm
Thank
excited.
You. Okay. So essentially what the Columbia Law School's Law, Rights, and Religion Project, that's an institution under the law school, what they show is that the Supreme Court's COVID era opinions have created a hierarchy of constitutional rights. And of course, these religious rights at the top. And then we'll discuss tonight how this happened, how this affects everyday people, where we are headed, and what we can do about it. And then you all know my story. This is just for the benefit of people who might not know it or look at this later. And here's a cover of my book, but it's really about showing you my only, one and only photo of me in Amish clothes and also of me as a practicing Amish person.
Oh, now, where can people find that book if they want a copy of it?
You can go to Amazon. You can just type in, Google Amish Girl in Manhattan, or, go to Amazon. You can also get it on bookshop.org, Ingram Spark. So if all else fails, email me, call me, text me, but I'm pretty sure you shouldn't have an issue finding it online.
Perfect.
So the first question, how did this happen? And just for anyone who's not seeing the visuals, there's a photo of We the People, that iconic We the People image with some bullets on it. And I felt that was a very timely example of what's going on in the country right now, like this intersection of Christian nationalism and all that kind of stuff. And so this is sort of what the report is referencing, not, gun rights only, but it's this religious drive behind putting rights, religious rights above everything else. So in a nutshell, late on a Friday evening in April of this year, 2021, over a year into the COVID-19 crisis, the Supreme Court issued a brief opinion that dramatically transformed constitutional law. In the midst of a once-in-a-lifetime global pandemic, the court ruled in Tandon versus Newsom that state and local governments seeking to curb the spread of the novel coronavirus may not restrict in-person religious gatherings more rigorously than any other type of activity, such as shopping for groceries or working at a warehouse. The opinion was only one in a barrage of cases filed in federal courts across the country, many brought by conservative legal nonprofits seeking to deny states and localities the power to apply COVID restrictions to religious practitioners. And if you're following along with the down the We the People of Faith report, you can see that we're now on the cover. And I just want to give credit where credit is due, which this is copyright 2021 by Law, Rights, and Religion Project, Columbia Law School. And you will have that information in your report as well.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing those references. It's always good to fact check even ourselves.
Yes, not only fact check, but also I try very hard to always give credit where credit is due. And even if it's not due, you should give it anyway if it's warranted. And everything I will be saying tonight about this supremacy of religious rights is taken directly from this report. It was authored primarily by Elizabeth Reiner Platt, who's the director of the Law, Rights, and Religion Project. And I owe, of course, everything to her and her team for having this information. They do really great work. So if anyone's interested in knowing about more things about religious trauma or just like our journey out of religion, maybe, or away from religion into, the secular sphere, I would definitely recommend checking out other things that they do.
Excellent. And could we just Google them and find their professional website that way?
Yes. And also it is on the second page of the report. There's I can't see it on my screen right now because I see a strip of our photos, but I believe on the bottom it says gives the website an address.
Oh,
do you see that?
Let's see, what page is that on?
So this is on the page after the cover page. So technically okay. Two.
I see it.
You see
excellent.
It?
Excellent. Oh, all right. Secret Eric found it and put it in the chat.
Nice.
He's texting from the trunk of my car.
Yes, exactly.
I love it. See, this is what happened. You wanted to know how this plays out in real life. Well, Eric gets, kidnapped and gets put into a trunk of a car.
That's the only way that me and Kara can dominate anything. So.
Right, right. To get him out of the way for a little bit. Right?
Exactly.
Don't worry, he's fine. Okay, moving on.
All right, moving on. So dismissing... dismissing evidence that group worship poses a graver threat of COVID transmission than many other activities, and that regulators can less easily monitor houses of worship for COVID compliance, the court has now ruled that treating any activity more favorably than religious exercise constitutes illicit and likely unconstitutional discrimination.
Hello, my name is Dr. Caleb Lack. And I'm a clinical psychologist, professor, author, and the director of the Secular Therapy Project. In case you aren't familiar with it, The Secular Therapy Project is a program of recovering from religion that aims to help secular, non-religious people find good mental health care. Specifically, we screen our therapists to make sure that they're appropriately licensed, use the most evidence-based types of therapy, and that they are secular and non-religious themselves. This helps ensure that science and reason are what guides your therapist, not personal religious beliefs. If you'd like to learn more, or to look for a mental health professional yourself, or if you'd like to apply to be one of our therapists, please visit us online at seculartherapy.org.
The court's new interpretation of the First Amendment amounts to a radical expansion of constitutional protections. The Supreme Court's new approach provides religious activity with a level of constitutional protection greater than nearly any other fundamental right, including the right to free speech, abortion, and racial equality. In essence, the Supreme Court has adopted a view of the Constitution that ranks fundamental rights in this way. Religious liberty is now giving top-tier protection, while others, such as equality and reproductive liberty, enjoy lower-tier status. And this marks a fundamental change in the court's approach to constitutional rights. Now, I just want to say that this approach is how Wisconsin v. Yoder got decided. So everything in this report is not talking about the cases like Wisconsin v. Yoder. It's talking about this is now, this is, in my view, this is what whoever was behind Wisconsin v. Yoder, this was their goal all along. 50 years later, they have now finally gotten explicit ranking, like religious liberty is now at the top. This is what they'd been working on all along. So now it's the norm instead of the exception.
Okay. Yeah. As you were reading that, I was kind of thinking it sounds almost like it's almost just an inversion of how I would think before of it being that, well, religious groups or gatherings can't be discriminated against to the point that they're getting, you know, more unfavorable treatment than anything else. But then it sounded like, as you were reading, that this decision almost kind of flipped that the other way, saying now they have to be treated the most favorably mm-hmm. compared to anything. Is that right?
It is, and I myself like cannot, I'm still working through like the languaging, but I think it'll become more clear when we go into specific examples and okay. It will get backed up by exactly what you're saying. I just don't know how to re-say it. So just this is why I'm relying on the report, because it's still new. I'm still, you know, processing it and all of that and getting my personal languaging correct around it, because it can be, you know, legal ease kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, this is really helpful to have, you know, someone kind of going through it and translating into English.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm going to skip ahead to the next page. I'm just taking excerpts of these pages. And if anyone has questions, you have questions, we can always back up or, you know, pause me. I can explain more because there's just a ton of good stuff here. Yeah. So this is now the introduction section of page 5 of the report. And so they just go into a little bit more detail about what was happening in the spring of 2020 when states and localities issued unprecedented regulations limiting in-person gatherings in an effort to curb the virus's spread. In response, churches, ministers, and worshipers across the country began filing lawsuits challenging these orders and demanding the right to hold in-person group services despite the risks posed by the pandemic. And initially, the Supreme Court declined to exempt these religious practitioners from the coronavirus stay-at-home orders. Months later, however, after hundreds of thousands of Americans had died, the court began to reverse course, issuing decision after decision, requiring that religious activities be exempted from COVID health restrictions. Now, these opinions represented the culmination of a decades-long campaign by the conservative legal movement to expand the right to religious exemptions under the law. And that's what I, you know, backs up my view on how Wisconsin v. Yoder was more or less like it was the landmark precursor to what we see now. In a series of cases over the 60s, 1960s, 70s, and 80s, the Supreme Court began to reconsider its longstanding denial of the constitutional right to religious exemptions. And there's a footnote, the first footnote here, and the footnote does mention Wisconsin v. Yoder and a couple other cases to take a look at those to see what cases the court was, as examples of cases the Supreme Court was considering. So this report does not mention Yoder specifically, except for that very first footnote, which is, you know, for me validates again how important Yoder is, what, you know, how much influence this, you know, has in the religious right movement and how important it is.
Yeah, that makes sense, given that, you know, I am also not a legal scholar, but, you know, my understanding is that especially for Supreme Court rulings, legal precedent, it makes mm-hmm. up a big part of how these cases are decided, so that they want to be consistent with the previous rulings. So it sounds as though this one has been foundational, perhaps, in these later decisions.
Yes, and it's been, you know, when it was decided, you know, the excuse by the Supreme Court justices was that, oh, you know, it's an exemption carved out for only this particular practicing religious group, and oh, you know, it's never going to apply to anyone else, which of course they knew was not true, but that was how it got, you know, marketed for among, you know, whenever, if it came up among the public. But it did pass, you know, it did pass through the shadow docket, which we'll get to a little bit later, which is also how all these COVID era opinions got through. So we'll explain a little bit more about what that shadow docket, what that means.
Yes,
but please. Essentially, you're not getting the cases are not going through the proper kinds of trials and hearings that they should be.
Oh, and they're going all the way to the Supreme Court?
It's exactly what you think of as a shadow. Like when you, so the docket is, you know, all the cases that are, you know, a legal term, which fact check me because I haven't looked up the definition, but you know, it's a legal thing. Whatever the docket is basically, here's a file cabinet of cases that people want the Supreme Court to look at, and they'll decide which cases they're going to look at. And then of those cases, they'll decide how much, trial and hearing and all of that stuff is going to happen around it. And the shadow docket means it's basically like the prosecutors, attorneys, all those involved with the case, and the Supreme Court justices have just decided to, yeah, let's rule, you know, make a decision over the dinner table behind closed doors, more or less, is how that process takes place.
I see. Yeah, I'm looking at that now on the American Bar Association. Yeah, good. It looks like what you're describing, where they don't have to do all of the public debate mm-hmm. and discussion and the lengthy oral arguments, but can mm-hmm. actually just give a quick decision for something because it's considered an emergency circumstance.
Well, it is considered emergency or something else. I don't know what it was considered as for the Wisconsin v. Yoder case, because that literally amounted to only an hour of oral hearing. 1 hour of oral hearing led to this case, and the public wasn't aware of it. I mean, think about this. If no one is aware of what's happening with, you know, what this report is talking about in the social media era, where we have a lot more access and publicity, able to spread the word. Think about you know, the 1970s, when there wasn't social media, it was so much easier to get these things through on the shadow docket. And 1 hour of just hearing whoever both sides decided should be put on the stand, and that was it. And it's shocking. If anybody's interested, you can Google and get the actual audio recording of that hearing that led to Yoder.
It all seems really shady. I don't like it. I'm not a fan.
Yeah.
It's all very shady.
Very shadowy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have my interns listen to the recording as part of, you know, their education on the Yoder case. And they always come back with just shock and anger and, you know, all the appropriate responses. And it's such a shock to what we think justice and democracy is about.
Right. I didn't even know about this.
Yeah. So this is how this particular Tannen versus Newsom and other COVID era cases came. Lots of these that got ruled in favor of religion came about is the same sort of like shady, shadowy process.
Sorry, so a little bit of feedback there.
Yes, I hope that, I don't know what was going on. Does it sound clear now? Okay, awesome.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, no worries.
So here's just a couple more lines to add for those who know about Employment Division versus Smith, which in the previous presentation I did, someone had brought up that question. They, in this report, point out Employment versus Smith in 1990, that the Supreme Court backtracked. It ruled, backtracked on some of the Yoder provisions. And it ruled that the Employment Division versus Smith, or that would can't invalidate some of the Yoder ruling. So Employment Division versus Smith says that religious practitioners must abide by all neutral and generally applicable laws, even those that unintentionally burden religious exercise. So there's a piece of the Yoder case that got invalidated basically by Employment Division versus Smith. Since then, a group of conservative litigators and activists have worked diligently to overrule or limit this part, this aspect of Smith. So this would reinstate Yoder in full. And they've now succeeded in the most unlikely of circumstances by gaining the right to constitutional exemptions from emergency regulations issued during a once-in-a-lifetime public health crisis.
Wow. So it almost sounds as though, you know, someone was taking advantage of these circumstances to literally just push through a bunch of seemingly unrelated cases. Like, this doesn't sound to me like something that would be related to a pandemic, but
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And so they were able to push this through, or you're probably going to tell us about this next, but like using this shadow docket.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. So we'll go to, you know, just the page 7 of the report for whoever's following along. So basically under the heading of COVID litigation and the Supreme Court, there's a lot more information about how these arguments were made by religious objectors in the COVID-19 cases. The cases were developed earlier. Cases that were developed in earlier waves of litigation, such as the Affordable Care Act's contraceptive mandate, state and local sexual orientation anti-discrimination laws, and same-sex couples' right to marry, they couldn't get those pushed through, those revoked. But now they can. Like, this is a consequence of the Supreme Court putting this religious rights at the top of the hierarchy.
Oh, I see. Now, how would that work if they decided, okay, we want to challenge one of these other things? How does this allow them to do that better now?
So this is where I have actual concrete examples coming up, which I don't trust myself trying to say it, you know, by memory, because I haven't memorized it. It's so technical. So, but I have these real actual concrete examples, which is going to shock you. But I have one more paragraph to read, and this is the shadow docket thing, where it says the Supreme Court's approach to exemption changes changed dramatically with the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the immediate appointment of Amy Coney Barrett to fill her seat. So that's like, what happened? How did we get here?
Oh, my heart is hurting thinking about that. That is absolutely tragic.
Beginning in November 2020, just 1 year ago, the court granted nearly every religious exemption request it received. this change happened over the course of months and entirely on the court's shadow docket, meaning without the benefit of full trials or extensive briefing. And in many cases, the court issued decisions with no majority opinion at all, leaving lower courts and legislatures to guess what types of restrictions on houses of worship the court might uphold. While the Supreme Court's opinions haven't always been clear, they will, as discussed in other parts of the report later, have a dramatic impact on governors and other elected officials' ability to govern. So what's your response to that?
Oh, wow. I'm still kind of reeling from where you started there with this kind of, you know, growing out of, you know, RBG's passing and very untimely passing, and how, you know, if people were able to roll over in their grave and be aware of what was happening after their death, I think that she would be, just to realize, I mean, she was the architect of so many of the other freedoms and rights that you described, which are now being threatened by this. It's almost like just a slap in the face to her legacy.
Yeah.
It just pisses me off. I'm just mad. I'm mad and pissed off. So
yeah,
it's awful.
Wow. And is there nothing to be done? I mean, are we just rolling down this path full speed now? Is there opposition? Tell us everything.
Yeah. So that was the basis for the poll questions, was, you know, how do we push back? You know, how do we, you know, work for justice, you know, push back on this injustice? And one example that comes to mind is, you know, the Texas abortion law, that crazy, you know, law that they, you know, wrote it in such a way that the state claims they can't be sued or held responsible. That is a direct result of not only what this report is talking about, but also like it built on 50 years of past attempts at getting to this point. And so one, you know, there are a couple lawsuits where people are not anti-abortion, but it's just to challenge the Texas abortion case. So if you follow that, I feel that's a very good thing to keep your eye on to see what is being done or what might possibly, you know, need to happen in order to reverse it. And for me, I feel, there is, I mean, I don't know how much time we want to discuss, but there's definitely term limits on Supreme Court justices. That's one step that can be taken. These are all, of course, longer term things, not immediate short term things, but still things that I feel should be addressed, or increasing the number of the people who sit on the court, so it's not, you know, so easy to skew it conservative or not conservative, you know, one way or the other. And then I you know, it's sort of similar to the Wisconsin v. Yoder case, which is we have to argue somehow that what is being done, the decisions that are being made by the current Supreme Court, are in fact unconstitutional.
Which, now that is an interesting argument, because isn't it the Supreme Court that determines whether or not laws are constitutional? So who checks that? Is there a check for that?
It has not, like, technically or theoretically, there isn't. Theoretically, the U.S. Supreme Court is the check, is the pure, you know, unbiased, you know, arbiter of what's constitutional and isn't. But clearly, they are humans with biased interests and, you know, able to be pressured or coerced or paid off just like anybody else. And clearly they've made lots of rulings that were not, you know, that constitutional law experts disagree with. And it's mostly been confined to sort of like the legal community, the finer points of, is this constitutional or not? And so the argument to really like have the authority to challenge the U.S. Supreme Court you have to know constitutional law and understand state versus federal. Like what falls in the jurisdiction of states and what falls in the jurisdiction of federal. And now the anti-abortion group has been arguing ever since Roe v. Wade that that is not a federal jurisdiction. That's a state jurisdiction issue. And so that's the path they're taking to try to keep, you know, to overturn Wade, Roe v. Wade. And education, you know, is not in terms of Wisconsin v. Yoder, like education actually is not a right in the Constitution, an explicit right. It is not explicit. You know, you have the explicit right to vote, serve on a jury, other things, but there's no mention of right. And so our, you know, what my work and the Amish Heritage Foundation's work is about is to show, well, actually to argue that we have an implicit constitutional, federal constitutional right to education, because we cannot fulfill or exercise our explicit rights, such as the right to serve on a jury and do that job properly if we can't, you know, if we don't understand law or have never, or don't understand civics or don't speak English fluently, you know, whatever the case might be. So that's one way of you know, approaching overturning the U.S. Supreme Court's cases is just you have to be better at arguing and interpreting and getting your you know, interpretation across to the other side. And then of course there's also another way where you can go through the legislation and get Congress to pass laws. And if you, like, say, pass, if you get every state to put education as a right in their constitution, that negates Yoder, basically, like, makes it irrelevant. Mm-hmm. It doesn't negate it, but it makes it irrelevant.
But I guess, obviously, the people who are in favor of that kind of legislation are working in the opposite direction, trying to make states invalidate or validate it. You know,
there are some states who naturally are more pro-education and others who are naturally, I mean, it seems that higher education, a quality, adequate education tends to be to go with people who are more democratic. And, you know, educational deprivation or inadequate education tends to go with people who are more conservative. And, you know, there's the question could be, well, why is that? Because clearly the Ted Cruz's and Donald Trump's of the world have all gotten not only a good education, but, you know, one of the best, Ivy League. They went to Ivy League schools. So, you know, they clearly value a higher education, or someone did that, you know, paid for them to go to school or whatever. So that's the question, like what's going on there? And I think that's, you know, a great topic to explore just by itself is sort of like, why is it that some people abuse their knowledge, their higher, you know, education, and others don't? Because it seems like what I see is that it kind of depends on the person. Like some people use it for good, other people use it as a way to maintain or get power. And the best way, and I always go back to the Amish population, you know, the Amish system, which is that's the best way to keep your thumb on a whole group of people is by keeping them ignorant and, you know, uneducated, unaware of their rights, and keeping them in fear of, you know, what would happen if you go against them.
And also too, like for them, you know, for people that are like mega rich and they get like they're paid basically, you know, they pay the schools, because do you think Donald Trump could get into like a really good Ivy League school on his education and merits alone? No. And but only certain people are allowed that education. you know, and the rest of the populace isn't allowed because there's only certain types of people that are allowed to achieve this education, you know, and that class of people and stuff like that. So I think there's a little bit of that going on as well, you know, and to keep people ignorant, don't give them an education, don't explain about their rights, you know, the things that are happening, you know, behind the scenes that you're not paying attention to. And also too, is also to keep the keep that class separation in place as well. You know, that's, you know, I think that's a little bit of what's going on, you know, on top of that.
Yes. I mean, there's all sorts of things at play. I totally agree with you. I mean, it's just way too complex to go into detail without going down a rabbit trail or
we can talk about this for hours. So this could be hours and hours of conversation.
I hope y'all are ready. This is going to be a 5-hour discussion, so get comfortable.
And you'll be mad for 90% of it.
Well, and I know we kind of got you off track here, but like we've talked about the education, we've talked about the abortion rights. Like you were going to tell us some other examples of decisions that are coming down the pipe as well. Like what else are we dealing with here?
So, yes. So let me bring that up. I forgot to like undo my share screen when into talking. Okay. Now I need to see if I can find it. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, you're fine.
Here.
Yeah, I am excited to hear. I guess excited is not a good word for I'm, you know, dreading to hear these other decisions that you're going to share with us. But, you know, like you said, part of being a, you know, engaged citizen is educating yourself on what's going on. So this is definitely great that you're being able to share this with us.
Yes. Thank you. And thanks for being on this with me as I also sort my brain through all this crazy stuff.
we're going to get through it together, y'all.
So your question, like, how does this affect everyday people? And that starts on page 12 of the report. I have a paragraph here that you can find in the report, but I'm going to just jump to the specific examples, not the general topics. And that is a religious nonprofit seeking an exemption from paying the state minimum wage could now argue that the law is discriminatory since it exempts contract and tipped work, but not religious work. And in the previous part of the report, it talks about how there have always been some carve-outs, exemptions, and there's always this act of balancing what's in the best interests for the citizens in general as a whole, which is why we have, you know, certain exemptions for contract work according to whoever decided on the exemption, or certain exemptions for women-owned businesses, for example. So a religious nonprofit does not have to pay the state minimum wage. A large for-profit company owned by a religious person who believes that women shouldn't hold positions of authority over men could argue that a workplace anti-discrimination law is discriminatory since it exempts small businesses, but not businesses with religious owners. So here's a very, you know, even more specific example.
I smell sexism.
Yes.
I smell it. I don't like it. It's bad.
Well, and you know, we've already seen challenges like this, like with the Hobby Lobby decision.
Yes.
It was exactly the same, but it was basically exempting them from, you know, allowing healthcare for women.
Right. And now it's just going directly for let's exempt based on you know, sex, gender.
And my concern too, like we were talking about legal precedent before, if these things start happening, you know, now that the Supreme Court is stacked and they passed these, you know, rulings behind, you know, basically the America's backs, that now the precedent is being set up that down the line when people are trying to overturn these laws, these things that are happening, that they're going to be like, what's legal precedent? And it's going to be even more of a challenge to turn those things over again. And it just, and that's the thing that's giving me like the pit in my stomach, that what's going to happen down the line.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you're totally right. And yes, the longer something stays, remains the law, the longer it acquires this precedence, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I totally hear you on the panic of like, what happens if this doesn't get, undone quickly right. enough? But that's where I would, optimistic response to that, or the positive responses, nothing is ever set in stone. If it really is unconstitutional, there's never a statute of limitations on exercising that, or arguing like this is unconstitutional, even if it's been in place for hundreds of years. I mean, think of, women not having been allowed to vote, for example, for hundreds of years. And finally, that got changed. But none of it is easy or like relieving, gives right. you much peace of mind. And then here's the last example, which is parents. And here's just, again, like it gets even worse. Parents whose religious beliefs support corporal punishment could argue that even if a child abuse law contains no exemptions, a state's decision to not press charges in certain circumstances, such as when the parent is also experiencing violence, should be taken as a de facto exemption, making the law discriminatory towards religion. Do you get what
Walk
is
me
being
through
done here?
That.
Okay, run me through that, because I think I understand what you're saying, but I want to make sure I understand exactly what you're saying.
Yes. So this is why I did not go into this, off the top of my head before, because it's too technical.
Yeah, this is very complex.
Yeah.
So this is saying that. Okay, so let's suppose a case comes in front of the state in which a parent was beating their child. And it could have been that the parent, and they're saying the parent is also experiencing violence. Well, it could have been that this particular spouse's partner or whoever perhaps like force the parent to beat their child. And so in this case, the state could make an exemption under the child abuse law, saying we're not going to press charges because the parent abused their child under duress.
Oh, the duress being basically their head of household was operating under the assumption that this was their religious belief, and therefore they could compel their family members to participate as well.
Well, yeah, I don't, that would be a case by case thing. That would be something that I, would be interested in seeing. Can like say in the case of the Amish, let's use that, the Amish wife who is mandated by the religion to obey her husband no matter what, the husband is ordering the wife to beat the child, but, just saying, the husband might never have threatened the wife with physical, retribution if she didn't do that, but it's just understood that it's, by the religion, you're supposed to do that. Would that be considered violence, meet that, standard or a level of violence? I don't know. Those are all like things that would be determined in a specific case. What I'm thinking of is, let's say the husband told the wife she needs to beat the kid didn't do anything wrong. The wife might, try to say, the kid does not deserve being beaten. The kid didn't do anything wrong. And the husband's like, beats the wife, keeps beating her, says he's not going to, stop until she beats the kid. So I'm thinking of that as a more extreme, obvious example of, easily demonstrated example of violence, physical is always easier than non-physical.
I just find it that I'm sorry, mm-hmm. that that's going to be kind of difficult to prove.
I think I get it. Yeah. Cause that's what she's saying, right? It's like, if there's ever a circumstance where they could say, well, we're not going to file charges in this case because, maybe this person was under duress, then it sounds like what this is saying is that could be taken by a religious person to say, oh, aha, you didn't file charges in this case over here. So now you can't ever file charges against a religious person whose beliefs say that you should use corporal punishment, because now you're unfairly discriminating against religious belief.
Is absolutely, 100%.
What the fuck?
Oh my goodness. This goes back to that thing you said at the beginning about how now you, there can never be a circumstance where a religious organization is subject to a rule that someone else was not subject to.
And I'm just feeling a little bit trepidatious, especially like in cases of like sexual abuse, you know, and like, you know, the Catholic Church and the Jehovah Witnesses and, you know, this childhood, all this childhood sexual abuse that's coming out, that this could be a precedent for them to say, well, we get religious exemption, you know, for, that, like, it just smells fishy and bad. Like, I'm not a fan.
you are right on target, Helen. That is exactly where this is going to lead to. I would bet my life on there, you know, like there is going to be at least one attempt by the Catholic Church or any other religious, you know, organization to get out of being try to keep from being prosecuted for child sexual abuse or any other kind of sexual abuse based on this.
Because my concern is that, you know, like in, like for the Jehovah's Witnesses, they have all these bylaws within their within their religion about how they handle those types of cases. And it's, we're supposed to have a separation of church and state where the state can come in and say, well, fuck you, this, you're still breaking the law, you're still abusing kids. And now we have this religious exemption thing coming and going, well, I can use this and we're going to handle it internally and you can't investigate us now. And that's the thing that's making me really nervous, and it's bad and not a fan. It's bad. It's really bad.
I mean, it's hard enough right now. I mean, there's so many, you know, religious freedom exemptions claimed already. The Amish church being one, you know, just one of many, you know, closed religious groups where they just have this de facto, you know, autonomy sort of, you know, and now it's even more impossible going to be like the rare cases that do come in front of the court. I just can't imagine that there's any hope of any charges getting pressed now, knowing this.
Well, yeah. And, you know, you mentioned this being kind of a long game that's being played here with these decisions sort of compounding on themselves. Where do you think this is headed? Like, what is the end game that we're moving towards here? What do you think the goal is of all this?
Well, here's that question. Where are we headed?
It's almost like I knew that was the next slide.
Yeah.
You're psychic, Kara.
Ask Rob about that.
You're on the wavelength here, Kara. So this decade looks bleak. Honestly, it's bleak. I have a lot of conversations with, you know, people in politics, policymakers, game theory, you know, people in you know, all that kind of stuff, economic and political game theory, like, it just looks bleak. And they are, you know, predicting an attempt at civil war, you know, in this insurrection kind of thing. If Trump is, you know, like even worse than January 6th, that same kind of attempt, if Trump is reelected in 24 and tries to get elected again in 28. So they're predicting that. And to me, you know, the racism and sexism, like this, the reason for all this bleakness is driven by old white males clinging to every last thing they can to stay in power as they see the demographics of the US changing towards secularism and non-white multiculturalism. And the Texas abortion ban is, you know, one of those examples of this recent attempt at creating and maintaining a Christian patriarchal theocracy. And I would say that they have achieved this theocracy with the Supreme Court now that it's 6-3. And that's really, I see it as our, you know, as a monarchy, our version of a theocratical or theocracy. I don't know if theocratical, is that a word?
We're gonna make
it. Is now. It's a word now, Torah. It is now.
And so the next slide, let's not dwell too much on that, because here's the next decade. So the decade after the 2020s looks a whole lot better. Younger generations of secular or nones, those who don't affiliate with any religion, will have grown into positions of power and authority in politics, policy, education, and so forth. And, you know, the better educated you are, the more likely you are to vote Democratic. And that trend has been building since 1980. The next slide, I think I was going to take that out of this part, but here's how I'm backing up why I think this is happening. So basically, sort of like we talked about this before, Helen, you mentioned this about wealth, like the wealthier you are, the more likely you are to vote Republican. And that's been true for nearly 100 years. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the better educated you are, the more likely you are to vote Democratic. And that trend has been building since 1980. And this is from a professor who wrote a book. I have to look at my... I'm going to stop share and just try to get that reference for you.
Yeah, that would be really helpful to see. Yes, that. Sounds like a little bit of hope, maybe.
Right. Yeah. So this is by Bill Schneider, who's a professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University and the author of Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. So that's, you know, he sort of breaks down this whole thing about, he has this take on the diploma, he calls it the diploma divide in American politics, you know, so the educational gap and how that's playing out. And now back to my screen, my other screen.
Screen sharing thing. We're gonna have to have you come on and do this for all of our shows.
Finally. So the Pew Research Center just came out on the 14th of this month with their latest stats about 3 in 10 U.S. adults are now religiously unaffiliated. That's amazing. That just keeps, you know, going for us. Self-identified Christians make up 63% of the U.S. population this year, down from 75% a decade ago? Wait a minute. Am I like misreading this?
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
No, that is right. Because I'm like, all of a sudden, I'm like, 75%? Okay, no, that is right. My brain can't process numbers at night.
Math is hard.
So this is all to say, you know, that the next decade by default is going to be better based on the trends we're seeing. Am I making sense on this, Carla?
Yes. Yeah. So basically you're saying the people who are building this theocracy are hanging on to a legacy that is rapidly kind of waning, mm-hmm. and they're presumably going to be more and more outnumbered as time goes by. Is that it?
Yes. Basically? Yeah. Yeah. I heard a very interesting statistic by a progressive outlet the other day that I believe 75% or like most of the Washington Post's readers are like 60s or older. Few people, like our generation, my generation and younger, is not going to the Washington Post for their information, which is amazing. So I think like that's also something, like that's one of the positives that has come out of social media platforms, like people having the ability to create their own channels and put out their, you know, of course it comes at a great cost. Look at what's happening, you know, with the misinformation, disinformation, all that kind of stuff. But so that would be my one, you know, concern, is that if we don't get education like, you know, made a right and enforced, then the 30s are not necessarily like they're vulnerable, because you know, the younger generation is, can go, you know, left or right. And what seems to keep them from going conservative is education. And if that is missing, that ingredient is missing, they're going to be the new theocracy.
Do you think there's like some kind of, like, there's been a lot of discourse about like not trusting, you know, experts, not trusting people that have higher education, you know, not like not learning critical race theory or something like that, you know, like all these different things that are trying to keep like young people from wanting to pursue a higher education, to go into college and stuff like that, even though it's really important because studies are showing now that you will not make a good income unless you have a college education. You're not going to get into the pay pool that they need to. You can't do that on a high school education anymore. So I'm just wondering if there's like this push from the right, you know, telling young people to distrust people that are experts, distrust people that have an education.
Yeah, like my, why that's happening, my theory is that it's so they can retain the control of their of their agenda, and they can also, like, you know, create their clones, their mini-me's to carry this on. And so clearly, you know, those, the ones on the right who have an elite education or top education, a good education, are, you know, clearly know the value, but it's this example of they're using it for a negative reason.
Right.
And they're, you know, they value it, but they don't want anyone else to have it, because then, you know, they know as well as we do that the trend is the better educated you are, the more likely you are
to the more liberal that you're going to be.
Yeah. And they don't want that to happen. And it's sort of like, in a way, I guess, like if you think of like, you know, survival, like, you know, Darwin's theory, survival, that kind of thing, you know, this drive to like stay alive. There's this like drive for the theocracy. You know, if you think of this theocracy, Christian nationalism kind of thing as a, you know, entity, it wants to stay alive. And this is its only way of staying alive, is if the young generations don't become educated.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting point, you know, given that, you know, a lot of this, you know, kind of evangelical religious right in many cases are, I think, believing in literal interpretations of the biblical text that would be challenged by, you know, even a middle school education, if your children were exposed to, you know, things like geology or, you know, biology, chemistry. I mean, any of the basic sciences would challenge these, you know, literalist interpretations of, you know, the earth being created in 6 days and these sorts of things. So, I mean, I can see how that would be also a direct threat, just, you know, from a practical standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this is speaking of critical race theory, you know, like why is the right, or, you know, this certain, you know, pieces of the right, religious right, so easily sold on this critical race theory? Because you can fact check this with one click, even if, you know, if you don't know about this. And, you know, so it's sort of like, it's become very Amish, this whole trend, this whole like political divide, you know, like where it's like this doubling down, like getting like more extreme and more extreme.
Right. And I mean, I think you're right. It's a lot of, you know, fear mongering, where, you know, it's a good way to get people all whipped up into a frenzy about something. And they're not going to fact check what is critical race theory and where is it being taught, because that's not the point. The point is to get people all excited and angry and emotional, and then they're going to buy whatever else we're feeding along with it. And fact checking isn't the point.
Like, they don't do the thing where, like, do I have to panic about this? Like, that's what I do. Like, is this something I should be worried about? And then I do a little bit of research and go, no, not really. This is fine. This, what you're talking about, is the stuff that I'm worried about, like stripping away of rights that's going on in the background that is slowly going to trickle down and affect everyday people. You're not going to feel it right now, but in a couple of years, you're going to feel it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? And especially if you're, you know, a person of color, or you're in the LGBTQ mm-hmm. community, or you're any of these marginalized group, mm-hmm. you're going to feel it quicker than the white people, the white,
exactly.
the straight people that are going to feel it, you know? Yeah. And that's the thing that's so scary about this whole thing, is that they're, and this is what I find, and this is what really bothers me, is that they, you know, these people that are extremely religious, they don't care about long-term effects. They think Jesus is going to come and the rapture is going to happen and all this bullshit. They're not thinking long-term mm-hmm. and what this is going to do long-term to our country and the people that live here and all that sort of thing. And the precedent we're setting for other democratic countries around the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. and that is also a concern as well, you know. So, you know, I mean, granted, yes, I am hopeful that, like, you know, from what I see from my own children and, you know, younger generations that are, you know, not in their 40s. So, you know, I'm definitely hopeful for that. But the whole thing just, it's bad. It stinks and it's bad. And I don't like it. I'm not a fan. Do not like it.
Yeah. And this is, you know, one of the things, I mean, I'm asking Elizabeth Reiner Platt, Professor Platt, to speak at our conference and talk about this. And she hasn't said yes yet, so I don't want to say, you know, she's confirmed, but I'm keeping my fingers crossed. And I really want her to address the education piece, because I feel like this is the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like nobody is talking about that. Like, and I see it over and over, you know, how Yoder is footnoted or winked at or, you know, dismissed or whatever, but it's not actually talked about. Like in one of those examples that I just gave, one of them should be education. You can now, in a state, any state, you can, you know, say, I mean, you could always do this because there's no federal right to education, but you can for sure do it now. Say, I'm not sending my child to school, and I'm not homeschooling my child, and I'm not teaching them English or anything, and I'm going to make them work in my business, and I have that right. I mean, Yoder already gave people that right, but very few people knew about it. Only, you know, certain, you know, pretty much the Christian religious right was pretty much the only people who were, you know, aware of that and really invested in that. But now anybody with this report and the latest developments, they can just, it's really easy. They don't have to, you know, fight as much to get this exemption for themselves.
I just find it really interesting how the Supreme Court now is interpreting constitutional law. Mm-hmm. No, I think we took it for granted that we had a separation of religion and state in the United States. And now, through some careful manipulation of how they interpret the law, they gave all these religious exemptions to, mm-hmm. You know, religious groups and stuff like that. And I find it really interesting, the fact that the way they're interpreting these laws is in their favor, which it was supposed to be in, you know, more secular people, like, or even if you wanted to, you know, worship Bob the Wonder Toast, mm-hmm. you got the same, you know, protections. Mm-hmm. Even now it seems that the evangelical right is fighting for their own protections and the things that they want to do.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Which, yeah. And that's an ideology that is not exactly compatible with this idea of democracy and freedom of religion. I mean, you know, the Old Testament Bible is not talking about religious liberty. That's it's not part of it. And if that's what we're implementing, that sounds, you know, directly in conflict with, you know, what we think of as American values and our rights and liberties, despite how patriotic they may want to make it sound. But that is very disturbing.
Yeah. And I also just wanted to like point out like the religious trauma aspect of how, you know, this, what comes up and with specifically with education, you know, like from an undereducated or deprived background, religiously mandated background, you know, where you're not allowed to question or encouraged to question, you don't know how to think critically, you don't know what questions to even ask about critical race theory, because you believe those in power in authority, right? They're supposed to be telling you the truth. And so, you know, I think there's this, you know, triggering, at least for me, I experienced some of that. Like, who can I trust? You know, I've been burned so much, I've been lied to. How do I know how to discern whether someone is telling the truth or a certain source is giving me the accurate information? And I feel like I haven't, you know, done much research specifically into this yet specifically, but I feel like there's a lot of like triggering that might be coming up. What do you think?
Yes, this is a big issue for me too. This definitely came up in my upbringing as well. It is kind of like, you know, what you were describing when you're growing up in this system where you're constantly learning that you are supposed to listen to those in authority over you and obey unquestioningly. That kind of leaves you without a lot of critical thinking skills or habits once you come out from under that. And, you know, I have conversations like this with members of my family where they're saying, oh, well, you're saying this, but someone else thinks something different. So, you know, we just have no way to know what's true. Well,
everybody has their own truth.
Like, so, I mean, I'm laughing because otherwise I'd just like scream, but I'd so totally relate. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like there's no way to referee ideas if you grow up learning that you just accept what someone tells you if they're in an authority. But now if you have competing ideas, you have no way of investigating on your own. I think that's such a critical part of, no pun intended, education that also, you know, kids are missing out on. If they're missing out on education, they're missing out on learning how to critically evaluate ideas and fact check and not just fact check other people, but fact check themselves, like we were talking about earlier. Like, where did I get this information? Am I engaging in motivated reasoning? And where's Rob? He can tell us about this.
Well, also too, for those of us on the opposite end, where like I grew up Catholic, but my dad was very scientifically minded and taught me to question things, you know, and being on the other side, when you see people that are so locked in and they don't want to question, and if you push them and you say like, hey, you know, maybe you're not going to get a microchip in your arm if you get the vaccine, just saying that the government's not really tracking you, you already have a phone.
Exactly.
Like, you know, those type
a
of conversations.
You have a credit card, debit
yeah,
card.
I'm like, they're already tracking you, honey. Yeah. Like, but when you have someone that believes crazy things because they don't know how to critically think, they don't know how to vet information, they don't know how, like, you know, those of us that have had a certain amount of education, we know how to vet things, we know how to fact check, we know how to look things up, you know, we know what consensus is and all that type of stuff. Like, you can't explain that to a person that thinks that, you know, the government is putting, you know, a microchip in their arm and they're being tracked and the earth is flat. It's really hard, you know, and you're just fighting against that wall of people not learning critical thinking and not learning, you know, or they say they're skeptics, but they're even skeptical about what is fact and reality. And that is also really frustrating.
Well, you know, I think that's definitely part of the talking points of the theocracy.
You know, right.
They put out the critical race theory and research for yourselves kind of thing. You know, that was created by them, and it just, yeah. The thing is that when you, and they also talk about, you know, they deride higher education, even though they themselves are, you know, educated by top universities. And so that further keeps people who have transitioned out of extreme religions and might have had a chance at getting on this path towards higher education, evolving out of like the negative aspects of religion, like they're just wrote right back into this state of not enough education, not knowing how to exercise critical thinking skills or develop that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, you really do kind of bring it back around full circle, mm-hmm. like with what you started with, that, you know, education really is, you know, a key critical piece to this. And, you know, it's not unrelated. Kind of to wrap it back up, what should we do? Where do we go from here?
Well, I wanted to have a site ready where you could petition, like send a petition to your local representatives, senators, you know, Congress people, and unfortunately was not able to have that ready, but we are planning to have this ready to go in January. So if you would like to have a site that you can go to with one or two clicks, look up who your Congress people are, and then send out a pre, you know, formatted letter to them about making education a right through Congress, then we can do that. And you can do that every single day for the rest of your life until education is a right.
Excellent.
And the other thing, so our plan is like, we want everybody, like we want all the states, people from all the states lobbying, petitioning, you know, calling, texting, or sending this letter to their representatives. Like, do it as often as you can, however often you feel, but just keep this on their radar, because then they will be compelled to do something to make some. And of course, like our goal is to get someone to sponsor a bill, and we don't feel that that's too difficult to do. It's whether or not it's going to get passed. That's, you know, we can easily find like Bernie Sanders or somebody, you know, who's pro education for everyone to sponsor this. But then of course it's the work of getting it passed.
And also to kind of tag on to that, like people have to start getting involved in their own local governments, you know, even down to, you know, who's on your student who's on your school board.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. Oh my god, thank you.
Because yeah, we tend to focus on national things, but mm-hmm. like I live in Florida.
Oh yeah.
And there's a lot of stuff going on statewide that mm-hmm. I am not happy about. Mm-hmm. And that starts in your own communities. You know, how are these laws affecting like people on the ground? You know, like all this grassroots movement that has to start happening, because we tend to look at the big picture, but if you're not paying attention to what's going on in your own backyard, you're going to get sideswiped. So yes, it has to start with getting educated what's going on in your own jurisdiction and what is happening and the laws that are being passed, and then go to the state and then go federal.
Yes.
You know, build from the bottom and go up.
Yeah. And that's, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's one of the things that is part of this site that we're developing, you know, this different ways that you can participate with this is like getting this on the ballot on a state level. You know, how do we go about doing that? And that for each state. And then, like you mentioned, the school board, that is so important. It's such ties totally right into everything we've been talking about, which is the religious right has been torpedoing school board meetings, like mm-hmm. all, like constantly in this past year, especially. Where they, you know, they're trying to change laws where they can, you know, like have a seat on the board, and they don't even have kids or live in that district. You know, it's that extreme. Or they'll just hijack the school board meetings and bring up all these conspiracy, you know, things, or these, you know,
there's a guy that yelled about anal sex at a school board meeting, and he was all worried about anal sex and some book and like children and like at junior high school, and he lost his shit. It had nothing to do with what they were talking about. They were talking about COVID mandates, and he went on a 15 minute rant about anal sex. So
that is happening. And at first, you know, I thought, oh, these are, you know, lunatics, you know, exemptions, you know, like or exceptions to what usually happens. But I've been noticing like this is coming up more and more and more. And so everyone who's on here listening to this, if you, you know, are in a school district where you can, you know, be get on the board, please do that and, you know, monitor and see what's happening, because these school board administrators, like too many of them themselves, are buying into this nonsense, this craziness.
Well, and like, even in my own district, like, you know, like where I live, we were fighting against like the state mandates, because like I happen to live in a somewhat reasonable county. So, but like, and this is the thing, like, even if you're, you don't have kids in school, you should be really paying attention to what your school board is doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, because this is affecting kids, and it's going to have a trickle effect, because like what affects, like the micro will affect the macro. That's what I always say, you know, the micro will affect the macro.
Well, and this is, yeah, just such another really great example of how this topic really is affecting, you know, everyone at all these different levels. I'm really glad you brought that up. And Tora, I'm going to drop the resources, the other resources that you provided, links to those in the chat. And great. As we wrap up and go on to the Q&A session, because I know we have so much more to say about this and we could go on forever and ever and ever, but we do need to get to the Q&A to hear from everybody. Is there anything else that you want to mention before we do that?
Yes, just a reminder, the Education and Religion Conference is coming up in April. So that's something, again, like we will have the date and everything finalized 1st of January. But here's just some information if you want to circle back later and you're interested in seeing the topics we cover in the lineup. And it'll all be related to the things we discussed tonight and things that I've discussed before in other appearances.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you. Yeah, we will definitely check that out. And this has been, yeah, as always, just super timely. We knew we were not going to be bored. We knew that wasn't going to happen. And I think we do have some questions.
Yeah, I feel like I got a terrible Christmas gift. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. I love you, Tora. Yeah.
I totally feel you. I do. Yeah, the you know, ignorance sometimes is bliss, right? Until it no longer is, until it's too late.
Yeah, until it hits us in the face with yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Well, I know we've had a lot of activity in the chat with people wanting to get involved here. Helen, do we have any questions from
I have one. So this first one is, would imposing term limits on federal justices require a constitutional amendment? All I see is Article 3 is during good behavior. Does this imply a lifetime?
I'm glad you brought up the good behavior thing. So that's something is open to interpretation, and it would take somebody invested and knowledgeable to challenge it, you know, to say this is not good behavior. Like, how do you define it? It's very super vague. And then the other thing is the term limits, if anything is happening with enacting that, passing that into law, is that the question, Helen?
Yeah. What imposing term limits on federal justices require a constitutional amendment? That was the first part of the question.
Okay. I don't know. You can Google it. And I Googled something right before I came on. I didn't have time to actually read it, but there has been a bill introduced in the Senate or the House, I forget which, last year, I believe. And I don't know what the status is on that. So I would say Google it and see what's going on.
Do your own research.
Do your own research.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what happened with that. I know there was talk about, you know, adding more, like changing the number of justices on the court. And that was really what I was looking at. And then happened to see that there was a bill about introducing term limits, imposing term limits.
All right. Well, we will definitely keep an eye on that. That was one of the things that a lot of people chose in the poll earlier. Oh, in fact, did we ever talk about that? Do we want to share those poll results or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would love to know.
Yeah,
I want to
see what people said.
Yeah, because I think that was the number one answer that people were interested in here in our group. Yeah. Okay. Can you all see that? Am I sharing it?
Yes, I can see that.
Perfect. Yeah, it looks like, yeah, 38% chose imposed term limits as their idea for the best solution as well. So in our little straw poll, that was the popular one. It's like followed by filing an extreme case that it makes the Supreme Court's rulings fall apart. And then 21% increased the number of Supreme Court justices. And then I'm curious as well for the some other ideas that people had. We'll definitely want to get to that maybe later on in the Q&A here. That was a very interesting question, Tora. I'm glad we got to poll the room on that.
Yes, yeah. I'm glad that it got the green light from you. Because I was curious. You know, I actually thought that people would increase the number of the Supreme Court justices, like that would be equally equal with the term limits. So it's interesting for me to see that.
Yeah,
that's not the case.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So it sounds like we're on the same page there. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah.
But okay, well, let's do at least one more question. I know we talked on and on, but we've got a lot of interest here. Someone else was wondering, if you know, has there been a legal challenge to the Christian Bible where it instructs people to live according to the law of the land? I guess that question, it sounds like, is probably asking, has there been a challenge to basically say, hey, stop, you need to live according to the laws in the country that we live in now, not the laws put forth in your text from another time and place?
I mean, I don't know of a particular case, but that's not to say that there might not be one. What I do know that's related to that is the Amish, certain Amish, mostly offshoots who are New Order versus traditional Amish. Mm-hmm. They call themselves newer. They're a little bit more, of course, like modern, have more modern conveniences, and then get more evangelical, actually. And there's a huge like evangelical born again influence that has grown in the past 50 years in conjunction with what we're seeing with these religious liberties developments. So their interpretation, or what they're starting to sort of like push, is that this verse about give unto Caesar's what is Caesar's. Do you know that verse? I think that is a verse.
Yes, it was the one about paying your Romans. Taxes.
Yes, is that what it is? Okay, yeah. So they're kind of like there's a certain faction, certain groups of Amish or Amish offshoots who say, well, that's, you know, sort of like that's why we have to abide by the law of the land. But it seems to me that if the law of the land is favorable to them, then they can use that as an excuse. You know, like if it's, you know, if the religion says no, you can't, but the law of the land says yes, you must, and if they personally want it and don't want to abide by the religious law, then, you know, that's when it comes in handy.
So it's kind of a cherry picking sort of situation.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, because if any of the crazy gays start making laws, the religious people are going to be like, no, you have to abide by those laws.
Yes. Only the ones that we like.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, the only thing I know about something related to the question. And I don't know if there ever being an actual case, but I would say that it is really, though, probably now the more that I think about it, this is really what's going on with the religious rights. This whole, everything we've been discussing, is they want to have the law of the land reflect or, you know, be in alignment with their religious views.
Yeah. That really does kind of come back full circle, like you said. Yes. And, you know, I think on that note, we might wrap up here. I know we've probably got some more questions that people are interested in asking. Tora, are you going to be able to stick around for the hangout?
Yeah. Yep, absolutely.
Okay, great. Then we will definitely continue this here in just a second. But thank you so much for coming and bringing this up and bringing all of these things to our attention. I mean, as difficult as it is to think about, I mean, this is important information that, you know, we want to educate ourselves, and you're definitely helping us to do that and stay informed. So thank you once again.
You're very welcome. And thank you for having me. You know,
yes,
both absolutely. Ways. I'm very grateful for this opportunity and glad you're interested in this and having these difficult conversations, some of it.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, I'm glad you brought that up. I have a book sitting right here next to my computer called Difficult Conversations, which I highly recommend if you're going to be having difficult conversations over the holidays.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, no, thank you for facilitating and leading us in these conversations. I think they really are important. And you bring a great perspective and sort of sense of urgency to it. So thank you for that.
Yeah, we can't fix it if we don't know about it. So yeah, thank you, exactly. Tora. It was wonderful. And like, even though it wasn't, I feel like I got not the Christmas present I was looking for, it was the Christmas present I needed.
It was not the Christmas present we wanted, it was the Christmas present we needed.
Yeah.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.